There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look into the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host on today's program. Hey, Hepcats! Come on down to the Bachelor Plaid. It's not just a place, it's a state of mind, and now it's a magazine. We'll be talking to Java, a.k.a. Jason Croft, publisher behind this new independent periodical coming out of Champaign-Urbana, but with the spirit of Vegas and beyond. You do want to stay tuned. But first, here's a little bit of what's been going on in our media environment with some Media Geek headline news. The proposed merger between the nation's only two satellite radio providers is heating up, with two FCC commissioners weighing in and the Justice Department saying it's fast-tracking its review of the deal. On September 27th, FCC Democrat Michael Copps told reporters that he's still skeptical about Sirius's intention to buy its competitor, XM. In particular, Copps said he hasn't seen anything about the deal that shows it serves the public interest. Republican FCC Chairman Kevin Martin isn't quite so critical, but nevertheless, he's gone out of his way to reassure terrestrial broadcasters that even a merged XM Sirius will not be permitted to become a local broadcaster. Also on September 27th, Martin made an appearance at the National Association of Broadcasters' annual radio show in Charlotte, North Carolina, where he insisted that the terms of its licensing dictates that satellite radio is a national service that must offer the same programming nationwide. Just 2 days earlier, an assistant attorney general at the Justice Department told a congressional hearing that the department is moving, quote, as quickly as possible, end quote, in its antitrust review of the XM Sirius deal, though he declined to say when he thought it would be completed. The deal has to be approved both by the Justice Department and the FCC. Satellite radio was originally designed to be a competitive service, and one of the original terms of licensing was that the two providers would not merge. The FCC's approval of the merger will therefore require that it also revise that stipulation. The National Association of Broadcasters opposes the merger, while the reaction from the public interest community is somewhat more mixed. Some groups, most notably Public Knowledge, have suggested that the FCC should require the merged company to provide dedicated non-commercial public service channels. Such channels are required of the nation's two satellite television providers, but no similar requirement exists for satellite radio. In other FCC news, the Commission's other Democrat, Jonathan Adelstein, has called for Chairman Martin to establish a task force to study the impact of media consolidation on female and minority ownership. Adelstein's comments were published as a guest blog post at StopBigMedia.com, and they come in the wake of the FCC's Chicago public hearing on media ownership, which focused on minority ownership issues. In his post, Adelstein wrote, "The bottom line is, quote, the FCC must not move forward with new media ownership rules without first rectifying the sorry state of female and minority ownership of media, an issue that has been ignored by the commission far too long. The time has come for us to stop talking and start taking meaningful steps to promote media diversity, because as revealed in testimony after testimony in Chicago, ownership is the key to having your voice heard," end quote. Adelstein urged Chairman Martin to create an independent, bipartisan panel representing broadcasters, female and minority owners, investors, advertisers, and the public. This independent female minority ownership panel should review the more than 40 policy recommendations that were proposed by the FCC's Diversity Committee and the Minority Media Telecommunications Council over the past 15 years. Commissioner Copps also addressed minority ownership in a letter to the editor published in the Washington Post on September 26th. In his letter, he praises a September 21st piece by Eugene Robinson, which he says, quote, rightly concluded that black radio played a critical role in bringing to light what happened in Jena, Louisiana. These radio hosts are to be commended, but I worry that as the media grow ever more consolidated, they are doing less and less to serve people of color, end quote. Finally, frequent Media Geek guest John Anderson digs up a little dirt on Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey. As a federal judge in the Southern District of New York, Mukasey heard the 1998 preemptive legal challenge against the FCC filed by the collective behind unlicensed New York City station Steal This Radio. Mukasey failed to take up any of STR's substantive claims regarding the anti-free speech nature of the FCC's licensing standards. Instead, Mukasey threw out the suit based on its preemptive nature, while also harshly criticizing Steal This Radio for operating without a license. While this case is probably of little interest to senators considering his confirmation, John points out that if confirmed, Mukasey would have more experience with micro radio than any previous attorney general. And the fact that Mukasey was reactionary and unwilling to see First Amendment issues in the case just gives supporters of free speech and broadcasting another reason to oppose his confirmation. You can read more about that at John's website, DIYmedia.net. And that's a little bit of what's been going on in our media environment. This is Media Geek. Check it out online at MediaGeek.net and get the radio program at radio.MediaGeek.net. And if you got any comments, send them to me, paul@MediaGeek.net. Coming up in just a moment, The Bachelor Pad in print. We'll be talking to radio host and now publisher Jason Croft. Do stay tuned. You know, Jason, I thought you were going to bring a cocktail shaker with you for this interview here.
Yeah, usually I have that travel bar with me, but, you know, I'm carrying boxes of the magazine, so I got to leave something at home.
Because, you know, here in Champaign-Urbana, it's just after, it's a little after 5 o'clock, it's happy hour.
It is. Well, I have one of those clocks at home where every hour is 5 o'clock, hence happy hour.
And welcome back to Media Geek. My guest today is Jason Croft, known to his listeners here in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, as well as all over the internet as Java, host of The Bachelor Pad. Which is, you described the program.
Well, it's space age bachelor pad music, Rat Pack culture, exotica, all the great stereophonic hi-fi hijinks that came out in the 1950s. That's what I like to do. Spy music, you know, Sinatra, the whole bit. And I've been doing the Bachelor Pad radio show since 2002. And before that, I mean, the Bachelor Pad radio show actually comes out of a larger project of mine. A website, which I started in 99, called Java's Bachelor Pad, which is, you know, the root of the Bachelor Pad empire. And all these other things have sprung from it. The radio show, I also do a online big pinup contest, which has been going on for about 5 years now. And then now, the magazine.
And now you're going into print. It's almost a retro step to go back into the world of print. From the world yeah. of the internet and the world of radio. And that's why you're here today. So you have Bachelor Pad magazine issue number one.
Yep.
Hot off the presses.
Yeah, I just got it back on from the printers on Wednesday, so it's only a couple of days old.
And I'm looking through this, and it really does have a lot of the feel, very retro feel here. It's definitely full of great pinup goodness, but even compared to an issue of Maxim magazine.
Oh, it's very tame.
Very tame.
Yeah.
So tell me, why make this step? I mean, this is not just something that you're putting out here in Central Illinois. You've got a worldwide listenership because you've been broadcasting your show
oh,
on
yeah.
the internet almost the entire time, correct? Mm-hmm. Why make this step into print, into trying to get this out all over the world?
Well, there is a certain thing. I mean, this magazine in and of itself, it's promoting itself as the new digest of atomic age culture. And there's actually a rather large contingent of people around the world who love this mid-century modern lifestyle. The, you know, who love that look and the feel and the vibe of it all. And pinup magazines were a big part of it. All the old men's magazines. And I'm not just talking about Playboy, which, of course, is the king of men's magazines. But there were a lot of second-tier magazines that came out in the 1950s. You know, everybody had them. They had stories. They had, you know, cartoons, gags. They had, you know, jokes. They had just all sorts of crazy stuff and pinups. And a lot of people who I've talked to, you know, love that idea of the old pinup magazine. And it just seems like such a natural fit for what I'm doing to print out something that people can hold in their hands. And this is the thing that people have told me again and again. They love the idea of actually having an honest-to-goodness centerfold that they can put on their wall.
Because it's not pornographic.
No, I mean, our centerfold is this.
Her
name is Kay O'Hara. And she's a great friend of mine. She's from Canada, and she's just absolutely gorgeous. She's a blonde bombshell. Mm-hmm. She's been doing modeling, this retro modeling for many, many years, and I was so happy that she agreed to be in the magazine. And a lot of people, you know, love the idea of just having the girl, you know, with the staple in her stomach. You know, can put it up on your wall, and, you know. And it is. It's very reminiscent of the 1940s and 50s with the classic pinups. And, of course, this, you know, as you said earlier, this stuff is really tame. Compared to everything else that's out there.
But still, I mean, in my opinion, at least, very sexy.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be, really graphic, shall we say, in order to be sexy. And yet, I mean, this is sort of a different enterprise, nevertheless, than it's not a complete duplication of a 50s pinup magazine.
No, not at all, because I do have, you know, not just the pinups, I have columnists in here who are, you know, playing with that 1950s sensibility, but of course, you know, not. Of course, we're all writing in the modern age. You can't escape, you know, the time and place that you're in. But we all have a certain sensibility of this, the atomic age, the mid-century modern that people have wrote into their columns. So it is. It's a mix of columns and stories and the pinups as well.
So how did you know, or why did you think there's an audience for this?
Because I know these people. I go out. I mean, it's, you know, they contact me because of the website, because of the radio show, because of the pinup contest. You know, I go out to all sorts of events around the country, burlesque events, tiki events, hot rod events, rockabilly events. And there are people out there who just, you know, you can get this feeling that they crave these elements. And it's the one thing I think is that people want the most is, you know, the physical objects they can hold in their hands. I mean, retro books are very popular. All these coffee table books, retro artwork, very popular. I think, you know, people want the tactile sensation.
In the furniture, mid-century furniture.
Mid-century modern furniture is
and architecture has also starting to be really appreciated in, you know, in a lot of places, especially out in California, where previously people would tear them down, mm-hmm. Sort of remodel them beyond even any recognition of their original mid-century roots, now are being restored and lovingly taken care of. And so, I mean, you say you go to these events, or they're like burlesque events and tiki events, and these are nationwide. And what kind of, I mean, how many people are coming out to these things?
Well, let me give you one example. I was out in June to the what is now called the Burlesque Hall of Fame. It was their Exotic World Weekend. They just changed their name. And that is their big annual burlesque weekend out in Vegas. And hundreds of people showed up. Burlesque girls from around the world. And, I mean, it just became this huge, big retro party. And I've gone to another rockabilly event I went to a couple years ago. It was in Green Bay, Wisconsin. It was at an indie casino. It was a rockin' 50s fest. And they had all these classic 1950s artists.
I hope it was in the summer.
It was kind of, yeah, it was actually early spring. And they had rockabilly people, and then, you know, worldwide, people were mm-hmm. from all over the world and you know, hundreds and hundreds of people will go to these things. They will make the treks, you know, because they want to be part of this culture.
Well, what is it about this culture? I mean, what is it that appeals to you? What do you think appeals to other people? Maybe things that are missing in sort of the contemporary popular culture.
Well, it's a rather complex question, because I think people are drawn to different aspects. You know, me, I love the pinup girls. I love the style, the look. You know, I love beautiful women. I mean, I'm not afraid to admit that.
So, sort of in the Betty Page vein, yes, as the most sort of famous and renowned.
Sure, and
example.
Even you know, and if we can even talk about, you know, the Marilyn Monroe look, the blonde bombshell, you know, that sort of look as well, the Jane Mansfield, all those famous you know, movie actresses of the 50s and 60s. You know, but stylistically, there's a beauty and a economy to how things were styled. You know, there was that space age, you know, optimism, and everything from car fins to radios expressed that. And it was also this, there was still sophistication in people's lives. They still had cocktail parties.
People dressed up.
People had this swank lifestyle, or at least they tried to have it, you know, even in their suburban lives. But, you know, there were still these elements of class, of sophistication, and a lot of fun, too. I'm not, you know, saying that. You know, maybe I think a lot of kind of what we look at through it is stylized. Of course, you know, nowadays, 50 years on, a lot of how we see it are the stylized versions, mm-hmm, that might have not existed. You know, mm-hmm, they might have been Hollywood images, dream images. But there's nothing wrong with stylized. If everyone's kind of like, you know, into the same thing and understands that maybe this isn't how the world really was.
Right.
But it's a nice utopia.
Well, you know, and if you go to a Renaissance fair.
Same thing.
It's very stylized. No one's really
celebrating. But there's indoor plumbing.
Typhoid fever. Yeah. Right, right. There's porta potties. And all the food preparation has been health inspected. So, right. You do pick and choose the parts you like. And so that leads me to my next question. I mean, so it's retro. You know, isn't there the worry of it being retrograde? Certainly, specifically with regard to women in the 50s, did not enjoy the same sorts of freedom and equality that they enjoy now in the 21st century.
Well, actually, the 50s were a very interesting time in society because that was the roots of everything that came after. I mean, the roots of the sexual revolution of the 1960s actually had their foundations in the 50s up, mm-hmm, until, you know, the early 60s. I'm talking about like the Kenzie Report, the famous sex study, and even the advent of the pill, which was in the very early 1960s. It was all part of this, you know, it's what happened post-World War II.
And the Beats happened in the 50s.
And the Beats happened. And, you know, the other thing that that people might not realize is there were burlesque artists out there who were just huge sensations around the world. And these were women, you know, making names for themselves, taking off their clothes. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's been a great biography of Lily St. Cyr that's just been published, talking about how, you know, she was so kind of outside the mainstream and just felt these constant pressures to be in the mainstream. But she made a name for herself and was, you know, was headlining nightclubs around the world, the swankiest hotspots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, the question is, you know, the outlook of women. I mean, a lot of the women who are involved in the retro scene, they understand that, but they also take it, their perspective in a modern view too, and in a feminist view. A lot of burlesque women nowadays are very, very strong feminists,
mm-hmm,
and they understand the roots. You know, they don't want to go back to the 1950s,
right?
But they like the elements that were there, and there are certain things that they feel empowered by, like burlesque.
So this isn't a Ronald Reagan fantasy or a right-wing fantasy of wanting to return to a time of 50s family values.
Not exactly. Although, I mean, I'm sure there's people who liked that idea of the nuclear family, but I think what people in the retro culture really gravitate towards are the other elements, the elements of music and style and movies and all that other stuff. You know, the social constraints, you can, you know, pick and choose what you want.
Is there an element in which you're also sort of reappropriating that culture and updating it?
Oh, yeah, well, absolutely. Even though, like I said, with the burlesque. I mean, all these girls who are doing burlesque are doing just that.
I noticed that burlesque has gotten very popular in a lot of cities, especially bigger cities, but in places like Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington,
Seattle, New York.
Brooklyn, New York City.
And there's actually a big
San Francisco.
Minneapolis is also a big hub right now, too.
And it seems, you know, I've not been to these burlesque shows, actually. I have to admit, I mean, and it's, you know, not because I don't want to. It's just, you know, you pick many things to do when you're out in one of these cities. It seems like they're incredibly women dominated. I mean, so it doesn't seem like this is the stereotypical sort of sleazy male promoter with the little thin mustache and the slick back hair and a bad fitting suit. It seems like it's really different than like the Deja Vu Showgirls.
Oh, absolutely.
Club or
something
like
that. I mean, there's really no comparison. And what you bring up is quite interesting. The Exotic World event, the weekend I went to earlier this summer, I would say it was about 80% women.
Really?
Who? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you look at the magazine, if you look at the companies who have bought ads in the magazine, a lot of them are for women's clothing. You know, a lot of them are for things, are products geared towards women, because they know that women, you know, buy into this literally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it is, you know, it's sort of people understand these different aspects. And I, you know, everybody in their own way has negotiated how to deal with retro culture in the 21st century.
Right.
And I think most people have found a good balance. I mean, all the pinup girls here, they love what they do. And, you know, I'm friends with every woman who has appeared in here.
And several of your columns are written by the
by
models.
Women.
Yeah.
And see, I think what it is in the 1950s, especially in men's magazines, there was always this playful battle of the sexes, which was lost along the way when men's magazines became more misogynistic, when, you know, there was actually things became more hardcore, you know, they lost that sense of fun. And that, I think, is what people have missed, is that sense of playful fun. And the fact that men can be men and women can be women, and there's nothing wrong with that, because there is a difference between men and women. And it's okay for a woman to get dressed up, wear high heels. It's okay for a guy to wear a suit and look at the pretty girls and buy her a drink or whatever. There's nothing wrong with that.
Are there any male burlesque models? Is there any?
There
men?
Is. There's actually a rather large contingent of what is called boylesque.
Is that maybe a future column or future article in the magazine?
Oh, I never say never. I mean, if someone wants to write one, I will. Yeah, I'm sure I could find a place in here. You know, there's all sorts of different aspects of retro culture that can find a place in this magazine. And this magazine is more of a general topic magazine than a lot of other retro magazines out there. There's a lot of great magazines out there, and I didn't want to be as specialized as them. Because there's Tiki magazine out there, Tiki Culture. There's Shimmy magazine that does burlesque. And there's all sorts of Hot Rod magazines. And they do great with the specialized market. But there really isn't a generalized retro magazine out there anymore. Mm-hmm. I think there had been at various other points. There was a magazine called Atomic, which is very slick. Not just in paper grade, but in, you know, design and that sort of thing. And there was another pinup magazine called Barracuda, which recently folded. But there, at this point, there really isn't a good sort of general retro culture magazine.
And so we're talking about Bachelor Pad Magazine. This is Media Geek. My guest is Jason Croft, publisher, editor of the magazine, also known as Java, the man behind Java's BachelorPad.com.
Yep.
Where you can find more retro culture as well as your radio show and archives your radio show. His radio show airs here on Community Radio WEFT, Home of Media Geek, every Friday night at 10 Central. You can listen to it live on the net at JabbasBachelorsPad.com or at WEFT.org. And, of course, you can pick up Media Geek at MediaGeek.net and send me any comments to Paul at MediaGeek.net. So you go into publishing. I know you actually have for a starting out magazine here, and you've done this. You know, it's a true magazine. It's not a zine. It's slick.
It's slick, yeah.
Offset published here.
Yeah, color, the whole bit.
Color.
Digest. It's digest size.
It's digest size.
So you can put in your back pocket.
Full of, you have a lot of advertising, actually.
Yeah.
So you were able to actually, that's one of the hardest things to do in the first magazine, especially since you're not doing this as a big venture. You don't have investors.
Right.
Or
it's just
IPO.
Me.
It's just you. What's the scale? What are you looking to do here?
Well, I want it to be self-sustaining. Absolutely. And at this point, after issue one, it's done pretty good.
how many copies did you
have? I just started mailing stuff out, and I think, you know, counting stuff I've sent out to contributors and to wholesalers and to other various people, I've probably mailed out about 300 copies of the magazine in the last 2 days.
And how many did you print up?
I printed up about 2,000.
Okay.
So I've got plenty. Plenty it left.
So you'd be looking for distribution, and you're looking for
places to sell? Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm already talking with people around the world to send them copies who want to do wholesale. I've got some places here in town who are doing wholesale. I've got Skins and Tins, Furniture Lounge, and XL on Main Street so far who have copies available for sale. It's also available online at BachelorPadMagazine.net. You can buy a single issue. You can buy a four-issue subscription. So, you know, I'm also, the other plan is to take this to where the people are, to actually bring it with me to these retro events, mm-hmm. and do the direct marketing. You know, is it going to be on Barnes & Noble's magazine shelf or Borders magazine shelf anytime soon? Probably not. But that's okay, because I think with the grassroots marketing, it's going to hit the people it needs to hit.
So are you hoping to keep this grassroots?
Well, you know, if I make $1 million at it, that's okay. If I have enough money to buy the Bachelor Pad Mansion, that's okay too.
But I mean, it seems to me, and just looking through this first issue, it's a lot from the contributors are people in the community, or people, yep. are performers and such. And it seems like, you know, this is a subculture,
yes.
really. I don't think that I'm doing it any disservice by calling it that. And you're working within that. It sort of is naturally a grassroots sort of effort.
Yeah, I mean, but I think there's enough people within this subculture to sustain it. And I think that especially this 1950s atomic age retro culture, there are avenues for mainstream people to tap in, and, you know, it's very easily accessible. I mean, just take, for instance, Dita Von Teese, you know, probably one of the biggest names in burlesque right now, is doing a PETA ad,
right.
campaign.
As in People for the Ethical Treatment,
yeah.
of Animals.
And so, I mean, retro, she is, you know, one of the epitomes and the icons of current retro culture. And, you know, here comes mainstream culture.
And updating it to vegetarianism.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's great. That's really cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Jason. Once again, you can go to BachelorPadMagazine.net, JabbasBachelorPad.com.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.